Okay, let's quickly review where we were yesterday, okay? So as I said, I wanted to, as a summary to the issues we've been dealing with in terms of interactions with Jews and non-Jews, gifts and greetings and presents and all those things. So I wanted to take a sugya that speaks to it halachically and philosophically, so we picked Darkei Shalom. So let's quickly review it, right? The Gemara says that what do we do? Mipnei Darkei Shalom, name some things. Right, we give staka to them, or we don't prevent them from taking manos aniyim, what else? Right, there are things, right, Darkei Shalom that are not related to Jews and non-Jews, right? You don't steal from children. We give Kohen the first aliyah, right? All those things that prevent fighting. Well,
Cohen to
Cohen, yeah, exactly. Good. Fine.
Very good.
Thank you, Morty. Okay. But we noted that there are two basic ways, though with nuances of understanding, how exactly this principle of Darkei Shalom works, right? What does it mean when we say we give tzedakah to non-Jews, we visit their sick because of Darkei Shalom? So, one group is to basically, right, one group of poskim, these markers don't work very well, bring it closer to Mipnei Eva. Right, what's Mipnei Eva? Right, Eva is clearly, right, Eva is, we don't want to cause hatred, right, the dangers of hatred, right? So Darkei Shalom might be somewhat synonymous with Eva. Now what implications might come from that? So we saw one from Rashi.
Only if there are Jews around.
Right, which is maybe, right, only with Jews. Right, because to tell non-Jews they can't take tzedakah while Jews are getting stuck at the same time, that's pretty bad. But if it was, you know, some sort of value, and we'll see what that is in a moment, right? Then you might want to say even independently, though not necessarily, right? Because we saw the Mari Korkus, right, and maybe the Rashba says no, that the reason we have to give it to non-Jews even when there aren't Jews around is not because of value. It's because it could still cause hatred, right? If you deny them. You know, if you don't go visit the non-Jewish sick person when you normally visit them every day, you know, visit whoever's in the hospital every day, it could still cause hatred. Then we said there are some poskim who say clearly that Darkei Shalom represents a value, right, based on the Rambam. The Rambam says, right, Darkei Shalom equals... Right, Darkei Shalom... comes from, right, Derechea, Derechei Noam, ... right, B'chol Nesivoseha, Shalom, right, so you get it from the Pasuk, right, and then he adds the Pasuk of Racham Aval Kol Ma'asav, right, which indicates that this might be V'halachta V'drachav. Namely, Metatiyodei, that the reason that we help non-Jews is not just because we don't want them to hate us, but we think there's an actual value of being kind, of being a good person. It's called imitating God. And then we noted that there's still two ways you can think about this. Right? One is to say that the main mitzvah of tzedakah and the like is to Jews, but, you know, with non-Jews, it's also a nice thing to do. But the way the Rav took it is the opposite. Right? That really, the reason that we help all of humanity is because... that's the main reason we help anybody, right? Because we're godly, we're good people. Staka is unique because charity has a limitation on funds. And therefore, when we have a limitation on funds, so you have to give more to Jews, not because we care about them more, I mean, we do, but because they're going to take care of us, right? I mean, there's a certain shared fate, right? But really, at its deepest level, the type of chesed that expresses itself with non-Jews... is the most basic form, right? That of Imatat Yudah. That was the Rav's argument we saw yesterday. Okay. So what I want to do today, though, is, as I noted, right, let's go back to this side. Right, let's say that you wanted to defend the position that the reason that we help non-Jews is simply to avoid animosity. So this is the position Rav Asher Weiss takes, right? But what we need to explain then is what? Right, what's Rav Asher Weiss's central question he's dealing with?
What's in the darker Shalom?
Yeah, right, meaning if both of them are just preventing animosity, right, then what is the difference? Right, I understand you want to say, look, the reason that, pick an Eva, pick a Mipnei Eva thing, right?
You can burn their children. You can let them out of pits.
Doesn't actually
don't push them in pits.
That you can?
Don't push them in pits.
Yeah, don't push them in a pit. Great. I understand why that causes animosity, right? Fine, they're all whatever. So what's the difference? So let's just look at Rav Asher. We're not going to read the whole thing. I gave it to you. So Rav Asher Weiss argues. Right, first of all, he says, why does he think, right? He raises the possibility that this is right. Namely, that Darkei Shalom means that there's a fundamental value of being godly, and that's why we're nice to all people. Why does he not think this is what the words Darkei Shalom mean? Did you get to Rav Asher Weiss? You were debating. I heard. That's fine. That's fine. Right, so first, if you look at Aleph, right, he look down on this page, if you get towards the end, right, all the way until where it says, Ach be'emet kol zeh tamua. Right, first he basically develops what Rav Aharon Soloveitchik and the Rav said, right, that if you're medayek in the Rambam, Allah lebedrachav, etc., etc. But he says, I don't like it. Ach be'emet kol zeh tamua. He says the problem is that in the Mishnah in Gittin there were many things that are obligatory because of Darkei Shalom, and not all of them fit this bill, right? Like,
but not all of them fit Rashi's bill.
Oh, good. Right, so he... Right, what's his argument? His argument is, look, why do I give the Kohen the first Aliyah?
That's not because of
Ava. Right, he's saying that's not... Right, no, I mean, it is. It's to prevent... In the sense that it's prevent fighting.
Oh, Ava, not like non-Jewish Ava, just
Ava. Yeah, just like in general, right? But he said that type of Darkei Shalom. I give Kohen first Aliyah so that when you come to laning, you know, not everybody goes up to Yosef and says, I want the first Aliyah. Right, as long as Mati is there... As long as Mati is there, so then we know who we're supposed to give. We know who we're supposed to give Rishon to, and there's no fighting.
If we have the beam allowed, then
yeah. We fought about this yesterday. That's nice, right? But it's not like some expression of a fundamental value, right? We don't give like Kohen Rishon because of the halachta bedrachav, right? God, nowhere in Torah does it say God gave Kohen to, right, the first Aliyah to the Kohanim. That is not like imitatio Dei, right? You don't imitate God by giving Rishon. That's clearly Ava. We don't want people fighting.
The only reason because of Ava, or are there other reasons also?
Ah, good. So there are other reasons, right? It's also... Because, so, now, I think what she was on to is the answer, right? Is that Rav Asher Weiss says, I don't like it. There are clearly things there that are not about Malach V'drachav, are not about this highfalutin value of, you know, being godly. Except, she was right. Who said all of them have to be equivalent? Right? Meaning, when the Gemara says you give Rishon to a Kohen, what is the Mishnah really saying? You give Kohen, the first Aliyah, always to the same type of person to prevent fights. Why Kohen?
He's a little better.
Meaning what? No, Vikidashto, because there's a mitzvah to show honor to Kohanim. Uh-huh. Right, meaning, think about it. Right, Rav Asher Weiss's problem is, wait a second, not giving the Kohen the first Aliyah is not about Valach LeBidrachav, it's to prevent people fighting over the first Aliyah. Right. But that only explains what?
Why
we chose anybody to get the first Aliyah. I mean, why we made rules. But why did we pick this particular set of rules? Namely, Kohen, Levi, Israel.
And also, why is it that order?
Like, why did we pick that order?
Wait,
Vikidashto. Meaning, the fact that part of the cheshbon, part of the calculus is to prevent fighting, doesn't mean there aren't other values that are floating around.
Right.
Right? It doesn't mean that they're not... It doesn't mean, necessarily, this would be my response to Rav Asher, right? Is not everything is equivalent in the Mishnah, right? Sure, maybe some of them are more on the Mibnei Avath side, but there are other values floating in the background, right? The reason I give first Aliyah to the Kohen is because of a Kidashto, right? And, you know...
Right. Is it halacha b'drachav to pick anyone? Like, that you make a system of picking? Is that halacha b'drachav?
Maybe, I don't know, right? What?
No one can go say in the Gemara that you give it to the oldest, wisest, and you like...
Right, I mean, it could be, right, that there is a notion of hierarchy. I don't know exactly. But there is a way of taking this, yeah.
Well, couldn't you say they're all b'halach to b'drachav, and one of the ways you'd be b'halach to b'drachav is to stop fighting?
Yeah, and it could be. Yeah. You know, who says, so who says that?
Rav Aaron Soloveitchik.
So, no, not, I don't know that formulation, but that formulation is really Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. Ah. Right? So if you skip to 16, again, I gave you these in English because that was where I found it online. I think the original was German. And beside, I'm sorry, Donnie. I should have put it in German and only you would understand it.
You would have loved it.
Yes, I just give you...
What does this word mean?
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure he either would have loved it because he would understand it or he'd hate it because everyone would just sit there, Donnie, please translate this entire, you know, 12-page article for me. But Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, right, takes that direction. I think that's going to be a partial response, right, to Rav Asher, which is to say, right... Even if it is preventing fighting, that doesn't mean that that's all it is. This isn't Eva, right? So look for example, at 16. So Rav David Tzvi Hoffman says, so again, Rav David, who was Rav David Tzvi Hoffman?
Student of the Rav.
Writing in German?
Rav
Hoffman. Rav Tzvi Hoffman lived in the 19th century in
Germany.
Wow. Woo! Shocking! Shocking! What is unique about him?
He's also German.
That's not so unique in Germany, but he. Yes, he had a PhD, right? He had a PhD. Not many classic rabbinic thinkers have PhDs, right? That's not like a. It's not a thing before like the Rav. You know, there were a few.
I guess
there's all of one person who writes in the Vilna Shas who had a PhD, and that is. The Rambam had a PhD. They hadn't invented PhDs.
Oh, well, fine. He had a...
But he would have had one.
He would have had one. Avada.
Conceptually, he had one.
Yeah.
Resurrect.
The Rush.
Who actually had... No, the Marzchias. Marzchias. Ritzvi Hirschchias. Okay. Anyways, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, he's involved with the Rabbinical Seminary in Germany. Okay. So he writes as follows. According to Shulchan Aruch, the support of a needy Jew is a law. Charity for the needy akum, while considered a moral obligation, is urged on the basis of Darkei Shalom as a means of maintaining peaceful relations with the non-Jewish world.
Sounds
like evil. Wait, right? This qualified motivation has become the target of widespread and indignant criticism. Now remember I told you that I wanted to get at philosophy through Lamdas, right? So he's doing that, right? He said, right, that this sugya makes people angry. Why? Because especially after emancipation... Let me frame this historically. Before emancipation, most Jews did not have a problem when the Gemara said negative things about non-Jews because they were like, yes, this accords with the people that I see on a daily basis. Right? After emancipation, Jews were less comfortable because they knew that there were non-Jews that they actually valued and valued them. Right? So, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman is writing in that context and he says, look, one of the critics has the frankly prejudiced justice, voiced his opposition as follows. The tendency underlying these rules is to create the belief in the Akum, Christians, that they have good friends in the Jews, right? Meaning this is just to make people think, pretend that we have friends. But then he says, this materialistic concept is pure nonsense. Perhaps it is an outgrowth of wishful thinking. That it is utterly unfounded is substantiated by the oldest source of this rule, the Mishnah and Gittin. The following rules were inaugurated because of Darkei Shalom. The release of game, birds, or fish from a trap set by another person is considered robbery. Objects found by a dead mute, etc. So skip to the next paragraph. He says, on the basis of this Mishnah, it is difficult to see how any observer can side with the justice's interpretation or to refrain from robbing the deaf mute and the mentally deficient in order to appear as their good friends. Right, he says, wait, I don't understand. I get it. Not everything there is... Right, he said, there are some rules there that maybe you could read as just preventing fighting. But really, one of the rules there was you aren't supposed to steal from deaf people because, right, from mute deafs, even though they can't technically own anything. Right? He's like, is any moral human being going to say, yes, we don't steal from mute deaf Jews because we don't want them to fight with us? Right? He's like, it's clear. What?
It's possible the Mishnah. Even if you want to say that it wasn't a moral obligation, this doesn't seem likely that it's to prevent fights.
Correct. Right? He's saying first of all, practically. Second of all, morally, that's probably not what's going on. But yes, practically, he's like, oh yes, we are all terrified of the violent deaf mutes. Right? He's like, that's not why we're doing this. Right? Like, understand. He's like, are we to refrain from robbing the deaf mute and the mentally deficient in order to appear as their good friends? Are we to support afflicted heathens merely to appear benevolent and generous in their eyes? Is this the meaning of peace? He said, I gotta understand. How do you read this Mishnah exactly? So he said, the commonly accepted translation for the sake of peace is too vague. The Hebrew equivalent would be Mipnei HaShalom, not Mipnei Darkei HaShalom. Darkei Shalom. The interpretation of Maimonides, founded on the Talmud and entirely uncontested, is certainly the correct one. What?
Why is he saying that?
What?
Why is he saying uncontested?
Because he's a good brisker, right? The Rambam says it, and therefore no one would dare challenge him. Not Rashi, not the Rashba, it doesn't matter. Right? The Rambam is right. That's basically what he's saying. He's saying the Rambam said it, and therefore it's obviously right. So he quotes the Rambams we've seen. Right? This is the Rambam we saw yesterday. Right? He said, even in regards to the Akum, the sages have ordered that their sick be visited, the dead buried, and their poor supported among the Jewish poor. All this, Mipnei Darkei Shalom, for it says, God is good to all, and his mercy affects all his creatures. And it says further, the ways of the Torah are lovely ways, and all its paths spell peace. Consequently, it cannot be the purpose of these rabbinical rules to obtain peaceful relations, but rather to offer and promote peace. Not to seek peace, but to create peace. The rules have been established not for the sake of our peace, but for the peace and welfare of all men, inhabitants of God's creation. Right. So he basically takes Eli's view. Right. This is a slight nuance. Right. From the Rav and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Right. No, but he's saying even if you think that it's to prevent fighting, it's not the way Mibnei Eva is. Right. It's not like, oh, I don't want them to hate me. Right. It's that. The Torah wants the world to be
nice and peaceful.
Yeah, kind and peaceful, because God is kind and peaceful, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, in ancient times, the practical difference in the treatment of Jews and heathens was evident in the fact that one could be legally compelled to support the Jewish poor, while charity for the heathen was left to voluntary agreement of the individual. In our days, when no one can be legally forced to give charity, this difference is merely theoretical. Even if the Christians were to be considered an Akum, which they are not, according to rabbinical decision, right? Well, we'll come back to that. I'll come back to that. Worry.
Right.
What?
I thought
wrong. The Rambam is unqualified, right? Unless he's not. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Good. And then if you just skip down here, skip down towards the end, he then connects this to the Mishnah in the beginning of Pirkei Avos, right? That the world is supported by three pillars: truth, justice, and peace, right? And that's what he thinks this is a kiyum of what?
Truth, justice, and peace.
Yes.
There's two Mishnahs.
There's one in... There's the first Mishnah, and then the last Mishnah, the Perek.
Oh.
Yes.
I was like, Torah,
Avodah, and Gemara. No, the Torah, Avodah, and then there's Emes Mishpat Shalom.
Yeah, we never...
You've never gotten to the end of the first Perek.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, fine. Good. So David Svi Hoffman says, look, I don't understand what you're talking about. Meaning it's true that there's a host of rules in the Mishnah, but none of them fit this, right? None of them say, right, that the reason that I don't want you to, that I want you to give the Kohen the first Aliyah, and maybe, so what? So people won't hate you? No, it's to create peace, right? Because to be godly is to have peace, to be kind, right? There is sort of a constellation of values, as Ruchel Chaim would say, right, that fall under Valach Levidrachav, right? Creating peace, being nice, being kind, being just, right? All those things, right? I mean, it is a catch-all. This is not like, I'm not trying to be fluffy. It really is, right? The Torah really describes God in many different ways. He's kind, he's merciful, right? Parenthetically. Yes. So someone wants to ask Ramon Soloveitchik about that.
Yes.
So as I heard, someone wants to ask Ramon Soloveitchik, and he said, wait a second, we're supposed to imitate God. God is also sometimes vengeful and angry.
Jealous.
Yeah. And he said, yes. Yes, and sometimes you're supposed to do the same. Uh-huh. Right?
Never
right?
Yes.
Yes.
No,
like, if you are a soldier, right, if you are a soldier and you are defending, right, and you are, like, faced with, you know, stopping a terrorist attack, right? That is not the time to have mercy on the terrorist, right? It's not, forget about what happens afterwards, right? There's a time and place for anger and for violence, right? I mean, everything that God does, what?
There are no liberals
no
here.
Vengeance, yeah. Well, God says, Nikomet Nikmati, right? Fight Amalek, fight certain nations, right? As an expression of God's vengeance. What? Or Midian, right? That's where the Torah says it, right? Midian, who made you sin, God says, Nikomet Nikmati, I want you to exact my vengeance. I mean, there's a time and place. He said, it's not, we don't We don't exercise every godly trait in equal amounts, right? I would be very disturbed if someone, you know, Gersley got up tomorrow and said, look, I'm going to be godly. I'm going to follow all of God's traits. I'm going to be angry and vengeful and jealous. The other ones, I'll just leave. But that's going to be my godliness, right? That would be very disturbing. Not picking on you. You know? I'm just using an example. It's fine. Okay.
I guess I'll have to use my other tricks and get you.
Good. But coming back to Rav Asher Weiss. So again, so Rav Zvi Hoffman, right, provides a slightly different interpretation that does allow us to include, right, in this understanding, namely that the reason that we help non-Jews because of an expression of fundamental value in a way that would explain all the evidence in the Mishnah, right? Namely, the reason we don't want fighting within the Jewish people is because
we like peace
because God likes peace. And the reason that we want to take care of the non-Jews and give them tzedakah is because we like mercy, right? Meaning we like a collection of values, peace, mercy, whatever you want, right? But it's not just so they won't hate us, right? It's actually because that's what God wants.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was going to say, can't you just say the classic, like, positive, negative, like, that's a good thing, and this is, like...
Well, that's exactly the point. Right. That you know, that's where Rav Zvi Hoffman is getting at, and the Rav of Vernon Soloveitchik, right? Yes, positive. Now, well, you'll see why I'm not sufficing with that. Because Rav Asher Weiss says, okay. But anyway, Rav Asher Weiss is not convinced by this, because he says, you know, not all of them seem to be straight out, even though, as Rav Zvi Hoffman notes, that's not true, right? You really can't justify even maintaining peace amongst the Jewish people in fundamental positive value territory. Okay, so he... What did I just do here? Yeah. But he doesn't like this. So therefore, he says, you know what? I really do think that all Darkei Shalom things are very similar to Eva. That they're really just about maintaining basic law and order, right? Not fighting. So he says, okay, but then what is the difference between Darkei Shalom and Eva, right? What is the difference between the Gzerot, the rules that are instituted because of this broader sounding thing called Darkei Shalom and Eva? So what does he say?
One to protect Jewish deaths.
So he says, look at the very end of the first page. He says, "Mikom v'akom nireh, da'av she'iker geder darkei shalom, minia machloket v'aktata, ach ein ze michshash yashir, shema tagia sakana l'Yisrael el mishum genura machloket v'chalu'el ulmeno aktata." So there are still two ways of looking at this, right? Which is?
Eva and darkei shalom.
What?
Right? He says long-term, short-term problems. Right? He says, if you don't give money to a particular poor person, right, a particular non-Jew today, what are the chances that tomorrow, that, you know, someone's going to come and then kill the Jews?
Not right.
Right? No. If you have a soup kitchen and you allow Jews and non-Jews to come freely, right? So what will that do? Over the long term, it'll improve relationships with the Jews and the non-Jews. If you allow a non-Jew to die at the bottom of a pit, and someone hears about it, right? Right?
That's so true, man.
Right? By tomorrow, there may be a pogrom if you're living in, 18th century Europe.
Or Brooklyn, or whatever.
Right? Whatever the case may be. Right? And therefore, he says... Let's go to the next paragraph. He says, "Venicha." Next page. He says, "Venicha bazeh dikduk lishonot chazal." The b'masha tiknu limnoa nezek v'sakana b'bnei Yisrael hegdiru zov mishum eva. Those things that if you don't do them, right, if you treat the non-Jews not like Jews, right, or you treat them with that, right, and that will cause immediate danger to Jewish people because of the hatred, the animosity it'll cause, that we call eva, right? It's to prevent danger. But those things that are like long term, let's avoid fighting, let's avoid strained relationships, let's try to create a more peaceful society so that, you know, things run more smoothly in the long term. He said that's what we call Darkei Shalom. V'ayin l'lashon haramah, and he tries to prove it from the Ramah, that v'makom dikal mechas mishum eva v'sheyera b'shvil zeh li Yisrael, The Rama's language of Eva, one second, Nachum, I see your hand, just give me a second, is if it's going to cause, right, them to harm the Jews, and Shulchan Aruch as well, Hechadika Mishum Zarkei Shalom, O Be'eino Yehuda Alein, Mutter Lazis Lo Shloch Lo Yedei Yehudi, right, the Shulchan Aruch in a different context describes them in different ways. It could be a case of Darkei Shalom, or you're dealing with a violent non-Jew, right? So he says, right, violent non-Jew, right, fears anything which is like, we're worried about what a violent non-Jew might do because of a single action that I did against a non-Jew, right? That's Eva. But when Chazal set up certain principles, like allow the non-Jews to use your soup kitchens, right, it's not like, you know, no one's going to say, right, if I set up kosher soup kitchen and 95% of the people who come in are Jewish, right, so on a given day, no non-Jew comes in, I don't go running around to invite the non-Jews in, you know, that's not going to cause, like, a pogrom. But if I allow the non-Jews to come into my soup kitchen, right, and, you know, an article gets into the paper about this wonderful soup kitchen that, you know, is run by the young Israel of whatever, right, it creates...
Good vibes.
Yeah, good vibes. Exactly. And therefore he says, I don't think, right, so Rav Asher Weiss says, look, I don't buy this whole thing, but I do think there's a difference between Eva and Darkei Shalom. Darkei Shalom are talking about those zeros that have long-term aims, right? Eva are those that prevent, you know, pogrom tomorrow because of single problematic acts. Yeah, Nachum.
So it kind of doesn't seem that these are more like...
Which is these? Please don't use pronouns.
Sorry, the cases, like...
No, that's no, that was not helpful. That was not helpful, Michael.
It kind of seems like...
Which cases?
What we're doing, not cases.
There are multiple cases. There's Eva and Dr. Shalom. Which cases? Give me a case.
Both Eva and Dr. Shalom, it kind of doesn't seem like...
Within Ravasha Wise.
Yeah, it kind of doesn't seem like you have to actively help them.
Correct. Right, exactly. And Rav Asher Weiss says that explicitly. He says, what's the nafkamina between the Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, Rav view? Namely, that we help non-Jews because we think that's what God wants us to do. Or we help them because long-term it's better that we have good vibes for between Jews and non-Jews. What's the difference? He says, the difference is it a het or dachuk? Right? Meaning, is it something that we try to avoid... And we only do because it's absolutely necessary.
Right?
So let me give you the question, right? Let me put it this way. According to Rav Asher Weiss, there's nothing wrong with saying, I'm going to set up my soup kitchen in Borough Park, knowing that realistically, very few non-Jews are going to show up.
Right?
If they show up, I'm not kicking them out, and I'll give them food with a smile.
But you shouldn't go set up your...
But I'm not going to set it up, right? Right? For the Rav, it would be very nice to set up the soup kitchen in Washington Heights where I'll service some Jews and I'll service probably more of the, you know, the local non-Jewish population.
I don't make a difference for the Rav.
What?
I think this would be the same for the Rav.
Fine, meaning...
In general, same amount of people come in, it shouldn't be that difference.
Meaning, I shouldn't not put it in Washington Heights, let's put it that way. Right? According to Rav Weiss, if I have a choice...
Why not? Don't I have a secondary benefit of the tzedakah that you have?
Yes, so tzedakah, fine. If I'm going to visit the sick... Come on, I don't know, right? If I'm going to visit the sick people, right? I mean, look, according to Rav Asher Weiss, yes, if I'm going to visit random sick people, right, then I should rather go to, the hospital in the heart of Borough Park where 95% of the patients are Jewish, rather than, like, St. Luke's Roosevelt, which is in the Upper West Side, which has a good percentage of Jews, but also a good percentage of non-Jews, right? Yeah. Right? According to the Rav, right, no... Like, that's actually a beautiful thing to go to St. Luke's Roosevelt on 59th and 10th. Right, because it's not a heter dachok, right? It's not just like I'm trying to create good vibes. Like, I actually think it's a good thing to do. So, like, you know, if I choose one day of the week to go to Borough Park and one day to go to St. Luke's Roosevelt, right? I'm only using St. Luke's Roosevelt as, like, an example because that was, like, where one of my children was born. You know, so I know that hospital well. It's like, you know, it's basically in the heart of the Upper West Side. Right. It's,
59?
It's, fi- what?
You said
not the heart, it's, but it's, 10th turns into Amsterdam, and Lincoln Square Synagogue is on 69th, so you're talking 10 blocks, right? It's like a eight-minute walk to Lincoln Square. It's pretty close. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, technically, it's the, I think it's the border of the Upper West Side, right? The border is 59th. It's like a like where Columbus Circle is, right? But this is all the way west, so it's, this is not important, but if you know the map of Manhattan, right, certain streets go like this, right? So 10th, right, at 59th becomes Amsterdam, right? Da-da-da, right? So Lincoln Square Synagogue is like a 10-minute walk, right? So if one day you need to, you know, you're living in Manhattan and you want to have children and you want a place where, like, theoretically, if you're stuck for Shabbos, you can walk to Shul, it's a good place to go.
Stay in the Trump Tower.
What?
Stay in the Trump Hotel.
Or you could just ask someone in Lincoln Square and they'll put you up for Shabbos, right? I mean, that's almost what happened because, you know, my first two children were both born Thursday mornings, right? So, like, I got home, like, 45 minutes before Shabbos. It was very close, very borderline, whether I would have been stuck. As opposed to the classic place to give birth if you're in YU, which is, like, Columbia, which is a less... It is. Most, and then people come back and they just daven mincha. Like, they stay at home in the Heights and, like, daven mincha at shul and... But anyways, not important. Point is, fine. Okay. Now, Rav Asher Weiss, though, notes, and I don't think this is such a kasha. Rav Asher Weiss thinks that one of his problems with saying... one of the problems he has here is that Eva, and the Eva-like takanot, aren't just between Jews and non-Jews. They're also amongst Jews. And he gives you a list. So, for example, the Gemara says that the reason that anything that a wife, right, maker adin, if a wife works, the reason her salary goes to her husband is mipnei eva. Because since in the time of Chazal, it was standard that a husband supported his wife, if the wife would then work and be able to keep her salary, right, that would create animosity. But therefore the Gemara says that if the woman says, look, I don't care, you don't have to support me, I'll just keep my own salary, she's allowed to do that, but to take the husband's support and then keep her salary for as her slush fund, right, we assumed, would be a bit problematic. That's Eva. For the same reason, if a woman finds a lost object, right, it goes to her husband. We have Gzeirot, the same thing with a father and son. Right, if a son is still living at home, being supported by his father, so he knows that there are many many different halachot of Eva, which indicate that, you know, I mean, I don't know what he wants to prove from that. It's true, like, we don't want animosity with anybody within Jews.
Like, is Eva an objective category or subjective?
I mean, no. Part of his point is that, right, even Eva itself seems to be, in certain senses, closer to long term. Right, because you don't assume that a father's going to kill his son, right? Because his son, like, didn't give him, you know, his lost object once or something, or same with a spouse, right? His argument is that as much as you might want to say that Eva is more like we're worried about one violent non-Jew, and Darkei Shalom is more long-term goals. Even Eva is sometimes used in more long-term...
Not kill, but immediate, like, fight or divorce, something like that.
Maybe, though. I don't know if that would happen in one time. Maybe. Right? Like, I doubt it. Like, if...
He's always...
Ellie, I understand you're not married yet. Ellie, I get it you're not married, but if, you know, you support your wife and she's normally stay-at-home naniach, and then once she gets a one-time job and decides to keep the $500 she makes, and that's your reason to consider divorcing her, right? I'm just saying, that doesn't usually happen, right? And if it does, your marriage has been poisoned.
I don't know, it depends. If I look back at the times where we need money for food and everyone's starving, it might be a big deal.
Ellie, are you planning for those times?
No!
Do you expect your family to be in that much despair at some time?
Oy, gewalt.
What type of future are you planning for?
Oy. Okay, anyways. So Rav Asher Weiss in the end does note that this is, that they're not, And therefore, Rav Asher Weiss says, in the end of the day, I'm not totally sure of this. And he notes that the Ramban in one place does seem to equate Eva. The Ramban in Bava Metzia Ayin Ches, in one sentence, says, Ein medaktim gimin davar v'nosnin l'chol, im ein nosnin l'goyim yesh bo mishum Eva, v'tznan v'farnasin ani goyim in Yisrael m'pnei darkei shalom. Right? The Ramban in one place says, we give tzedakah to non-Jews, m'pnei Eva, m'pnei darkei shalom. Right? So... Then he says, you know what, maybe this whole thing is wrong, and Ava slash Dark A Shalom include all of this, and really there is no difference. Right? So that's his okay. That's his maskana.
Oh, great.
Right?
Sick.
What?
So easy.
Yes. Good. So let's just review this.
Why don't you start off with that? There's a plus bits of Ava and Jarman.
Oh, they're the same. Yes. Yes.
Correct.
Do you mean by two different things?
So that's what he's saying. The Ramban seems to not think this. And then he leaves it with Sarah Elam. Okay. So, one second. Let me just summarize and then we'll take a question, okay? So, I know this is a bit complicated, so let's just get this straight, guys, okay? So, we have all these things that we do for non-Jews, Mimei Darkei Shalom. We have two basic conceptions of why that is. You have the Rav, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who say, you know, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, who all say, the reason we help non-Jews is because we actually value helping non-Jews, right? Why? So, according to the Rav and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, because being kind and recognizing the humanity in every person is a kiyum of Halacha B'drachav. According to Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, it's a little bit different. It's creating a peaceful, kind world is godly. Those are two nuances, which explain, I think Rav David Tzvi Hoffman's a little bit better, I'll be honest, at explaining some of the other evidence in the Brice, in the Mishnah, which is like, we don't want a Kohen and Levi fighting over Aliyah b'nei Darkei Shalom, right? It's not because giving the Kohen the first Aliyah is a Matatio Day, it's because the generic peace in Shul is something that God wants, right? Shocking. God wants us to get along in Shul. I know, this is terrible. Terrible, right? Terrible. Okay. Then you have Rav Asher Weiss, who says, no, I think basically the reason we help non-Jews is Mipnei Eva, because we want to avoid animosity. He suggests that maybe the difference between Eva and Darkei Shalom are long-term or short-term goals. But he says, even that, maybe it's sometimes true, but it's definitely not absolute, right? Because he said some of the Eva rules, especially those that apply between Jews, right? Like husband getting his wife's salary because he supports her, except in the imaginary world that Ellie lives in, right? Most
well,
husbands...
I don't think it's so crazy back then when they had three wives and they all needed...
Fine, in the world that Ellie is convinced existed...
No, in the world when the Gemara made it.
Look, in the... Ellie apparently thinks that the Gemara lived in a time of, like, barbarians in caves where they had no food and, like, the wife... You know, one day happened to catch a deer while everyone else is starving to death, and she hid it and was eating privately, and then her husband catches her eating the deer and divorces her, and therefore it's...
This would be a more likely case than her just making $500. You know, like, if it's all going on at that time period, his case makes more sense than what you're claiming.
It would be money and I need food.
At the time you're describing, it wasn't... That's what it would have been.
Whatever, look,
this is how
quick,
thing.
Quick
I don't
few
know.
Bucks would have been.
Look, Ellie, I don't know exactly what world you're living in. So Rav Asher Weiss, though, notes that at least when Mipnei Eva is used in the Jewish context, right, amongst Jews, it tends to also be talking about long-term goals, right? Like peace within the family. And therefore, he says maybe they really are the same thing. Maybe sometimes Eva is used for more short-term goals and Darkei Shalom is generally used for more long-term goals. But he thinks really fundamentally... Right? Eva, Darkei Shalom are the same thing. They're to avoid animosity. If you're interested, guys, I know that in Rav Ginsburg's show you spent a little bit more time on this, so I included it for you, though I'm not going to get into it now. In section Bet, he goes through how expansive we are, like how many things were actually matzah because of Eva. Like, how far can we go with this? Like, how magical is this? Is this hat there? Yes. Like, if a Jew, non-Jew is at the bottom of a pit and I leave him there, and someone finds out about it, right, there might be a pogrom tomorrow, right? If I don't actively set up soup kitchens that will facilitate non-Jews coming, that's unlikely to cause a pogrom tomorrow, but it will fail to create good vibes between Jews and non-Jews. Right, that's good, okay, good.
Good vibes.
Good vibes. That was Shimon's.
Yeah, good vibes, no pogrom, man.
Good.
Come on, it's a good one.
Okay, good. Fine. The guys in my share saw this tshuva number 18. I'll go back again. I don't know where this is from, but some guy posted this online that he asked Rabbi Y. Berkowitz, "Is it permitted to daven for non-Jews who are ill?" I copied that.
Rabbi Y. Berkowitz.
Yes, exactly that one. So there are many poskim who think you're not allowed to daven for non-Jews. Because of Lo Sechanim, based on a Kolbo. Yes, it's a Kolbo, which is quoted in the Mogen Avram on Shulchan Aruch and in the Taz. So it's in, you know, the two main commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. It is It's not like this sheet that doesn't exist anywhere. It does. But several major post-Kim seem to have not had a problem with this. Ramosha Feinstein, Rubavadi Yosef, to name two. The reason that this, right, why Berkowitz didn't have a problem, is fits into this thing, and he says, you are allowed to daven for a guy. If it's a customer you care about and you feel their pain, what's wrong with saying a tefillah, especially if they asked you to? Hashkafically, it is correct to feel for a guy's acquaintance and not to be indifferent to their pain. Don't get close to them, but certainly feel for them. It's not any less than Merachem Aval Koma Asav. Right, but his basic argument is, well, Dargei Shalom in the rough sense, meaning God cares about all of humanity, so why shouldn't you? Right? What's wrong with that? Right? Okay. Fine.
Also, we said it's not really...
Yeah, it's not a matana. Okay, good. Now let me get a little bit more straight ashkafic with you for a moment, okay? So, what we've seen so far is that, right, there is this misura, you know, it tends to emerge more clearly post-emancipation, not surprisingly, from Rav Zvi Hoffman, from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, from the Rav, that our relationships with non-Jews and the positives that we do for non-Jews are not just...
Emancipation, you mean the second half of the 20th century?
No, I mean since Jews became citizens, in the literally emancipation.
Oh, like round one.
Like...
Napoleon.
Yes. Yes. Like, I mean, like, that is like... When
No, I'm not denying.
I know. I'm not denying that the Rambam seems to say this. I'm saying the most expansive writers about this are not surprisingly people who lived in a world where they wanted to write good things about non-Jews, right?
And the Rambam did also.
Right, the Rambam did also. I'm not saying they made it up. I'm just saying. Look. Someone who was living through pogroms probably didn't have this like deep-seated motivation to like write pages and pages about how much he liked non-Jews. Well, the Rambam was unique. We've established that, right? The Rambam was awesome. Okay, as Rav Zvi Hoffman said, he's always right unless I disagree with him. All right. So what? Just the Rambam. No. It's when the Rambam is right, he's right. In a singular way.
Right.
I don't know what he means. Okay, I have no idea. It's not important. But I think this is a good sugya because it points out, look, guys, it points out that especially if you accept this understanding of the Rambam, not only does it have halachic nafkaminas, right? Like, should I try to avoid it or not, right? Which according to the Rambam, no. Like, you actively should try to find ways of giving stucco to non-Jews and visiting their sick and doing nice things because that's what God wants in this world. It also indicates that despite everything we've learned in Masechet Avodah Zarah, that we have limited business interactions with them, we have limited, right, we don't go to their parties, and we don't drink with them, and we don't eat the food they produce, and all these different zerot, right, you might get caught up in that and think, oh, that's because we hate them, right? And the sugya of Darkei Shalom gives you a nice halachic language to tell you, not just hashkafically, but halachically, no, like God wants you to care about them, right? You're supposed to, right, have mercy and compassion and even like them because God does, right? Because God cares about all of humanity. And post-emancipation, this became more important. People really wanted to think about this because it's one thing for the Rambam who, like, somehow managed to deep down really value all human beings, even though like he spent his life running away from them and then was basically coerced into being the royal doctor to the point like, and you know worked insane hours to keep this job, and it still wasn't exactly the most comfortable of jobs in the world, right? You know, working for a sultan or whatever he was in Egypt, you know, like if you messed up, you know, I doubt it was like, and there wasn't like, there wasn't malpractice insurance. It wasn't like you made a mistake on the sultan's daughter and like, you know, it was okay, someone else will deal with it, right? Like, the consequences, right? He's not necessarily someone who had, you know, an easy life in that sense, easier than probably Rashi, but in the modern period, people really wanted to think about it this way. So one way to talk about it is through Darkei Shalom. A second one is, and this is something you find interestingly in the modern period, is, and I know we've said this 100 times in the Sugya of Lo Sechanim, but one of the main ways of limiting the Sugya of Lo Sechanim, of who you can't do business with and who you can't rent land to, is, what's the first way I always did it? The who. Which non-Jews are we talking about? Right? So, right, the Smog and the Ravid say it's only the Shivam and the Seven Nations. And, right, the Rajba says, thank you, that it's only idolaters. But there is one magic shita that everyone in the modern period suddenly really likes, and that is?
Only
the Miri. Right? That all of this, all the things that we talk about negative and non-Jews in was about those barbarians back then. Right? But nowadays, all the non-Jews you know probably are... Gidurim b'gidrei adatot, right? Are civilized by religion, and therefore almost none of these laws apply to them. Right? That's the position of the Meiri. Now, despite the fact that the Meiri is not like the most quoted Rishon, I don't think he's as like nidach as some people think he is. I really don't. Like he's not like some outlier. Like some people think, like Meiri is such an outlier. I don't think that's true.
He's like just like recently.
So it's not true. Like, we had the Shita Mekubetzet, and the Shita Mekubetzet quotes Meiri all the time. He quotes Meiri more than he quotes the Ritva, but people think of the Ritva as mainstream because...
He had the R.
And probably...
What?
He had the R.
Yeah, I'm a confused,
right? The Ration firms... Yo, Rashi, Rambam, Rambam...
What?
Rosh,
Cook, he didn't mention Meiri. You know,
not true.
His main argument was the Ravid and the Rashi.
Yeah, but like, if Herzog quoted Meiri... Saying it's not like uncommon. The Miri is not uncommon. It really isn't. I think part of it is that... No, I think honestly part of it is that just in general people quote Provence less. Right? That I think like the Ritva is just a Talmud of the... What?
Is that France?
The Southern France. Southern France. I think the reason was just that the Ritva, at the end of the day, is part of the base measures of the Rajba and the Ramban. So like the fact... People don't even notice that we didn't have the Ritva because like... Most of what he says can be found in the Rashba and the Ramban, so it's not a Chiddush. But the Meiri is a pretty, in the end of the day, is actually a pretty standard Rishon if you compare him to what else is written in Provence.
Isn't he later?
Not by much.
No.
No, I mean later than the Ramban, not so much later than the Ritva.
No.
No. Right? He just lived in Provence, but, you know, in general, people quote Provence less, right? I mean, who are the Rishonim of Provence?
Meiri.
Yeah, who else?
The
Ritva?
No.
The Ravid. The Baal Hamor, right? The Sefer HaMa'orot, the Sefer HaShlama, the Sefer HaMichtam, the Chochmei Provencer of Avram Minahar, of Yaakov Minahar. Right? These are Rishonim that in general I think people quote less, right? Except for maybe the Ravid, right? But we said, so I don't think, be that as it may, this the Meiri presents a position which Meishir knows, and you know I've mentioned it in passing. The Meiri has again this notion that many of the limitations on our relationships with non-Jews are only to non-Jews who are not gedurim b'gidrei atadot, who are basically not civilized, right? And you know I showed my guys probably the most striking one, the shita of the Ritva, of the Meiri in this is that he thinks this is true even of an apostate. Namely, he thinks Meridin Velo Ma'alin applies to, in Ovid Avodah Zarah, right? Right, you know, you throw him in the bottom of the pit, right? Or a Mumar, right, a Jew who apostatizes, unless he converts to Christianity. But if he converts to Christianity and becomes civilized in another religion, then he wouldn't be Meridin Velo Ma'alin. What? So that's what he thinks. He thinks religion... How well do you guys know the political philosophy of the founding fathers?
Pretty good.
Yeah, not bad.
All men are
the of the impact of religion on the state.
Oh, they weren't so religious, but they thought that religion creates a...
Correct. That the early founding fathers weren't themselves that religious. Many of them were deists. Right, but they thought that they believed that there was a God, but he wasn't necessarily involved. Right, but they thought that the state couldn't function without religion. Right? They thought that if people were not religious, they wouldn't be civilized, and laws would not be enough to contain them. Right? They thought that a limited government was only possible in a world that was basically ethical because of ethical monotheism. Right? That was their belief. And that was why they weren't vocal about their deism. So the Meiri, I think, has a philosophy something like that. I mean, not that he wasn't religious, he was. But he also thinks that religion, especially ethical monotheism, accomplishes a certain civilizing of society, right, that moved the world away from barbarism to civilization. And therefore, in such a world, we can value the nations around us in a more fundamental way than we would have in the barbaric pagan times. There are many modern thinkers, and this is an interesting phenomenon. Guys, Zed. Right, there's an interesting phenomenon that in the modern period, many post-Skim felt that we have no choice, either because it resonated with them or they just thought it was necessary, to paskin like the Meiri. It's quoted already in the Ber HaGolah on Shulchan Aruch. It was used by the Beis Din of Napoleon. Right, Napoleon had a Sanhedrin.
Really?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. And I think his... Yes. Yes.
Really?
He had it. Yes, he really had a Sanhedrin. And they utilized the Meiri a lot. A lot, a lot.
Why did he have a Sanhedrin?
Because he wanted to know the Jewish position on things. And it was emancipation. He wanted to be able to bring Jews in. He wanted to be convinced that Jews could interact with other citizens.
How many
right?
People?
What?
No, we the whole
how many people?
Like 71.
Was it? It might have been. It might have been 70. I forget exactly.
Why would it have the agreement of Rove Hoffman Yisrael?
No, it wasn't a halachic Sanhedrin. But many of their psakim, guys, many of their psakim relied on the Meiri because they needed to convince Napoleon that Jews could be functioning members of society and treat other citizens with respect. Right? And then poskim like Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, even Ray Willig, right, I've heard recently, who like, you know, I don't know why I said even, but like, Ad Hayom, like, you know, will say that, yes, like, as Halacha L'maisa, we should paskin like the Meiri. And therefore, we should as much as possible limit all these Isurim that try to drive a wedge, between us and non-Jews, and limit them based on the understanding of Meiri, which basically relegates these Yisurim to thousands of years ago because we functionally do recognize the value of our fellow citizens. Like we do, not like as a Mipnei Eva, but because we really do, right? And therefore there's this halachic tradition which was less quoted, I think, a few hundred years ago, right? But apparently Ray Willig, I heard Ray Leibowitz quote Ray Willig as saying that nowadays he doesn't even think it's a minority position. But he thinks that so many modern poskim have signed on to this, or Herzog, right? Many poskim have signed on to this notion, right? That he thinks it's actually becoming a, if not a dominant voice, a non-minority voice, right? A non-weak, not a Shitas Yachid voice, right? Not a majority, but it's not a Shitas Yachid anymore. There are many poskim who really think we should, as much as possible, limit the application of these halachot that, for lack of a better word, discriminate between Jews and non-Jews. So then Eli asks a good question. Does that mean that we eliminate everything? Right? Does that mean we value the non-Jewish world and therefore we're going to get rid of everything? Forget Bishalakum, right? Let's just intermarry, right? Right? Is that what we're going to say?
Well, he has a whole intermarry.
What?
His whole intermarriage is one of the barbarian ones.
Good. Perfect. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was the one who most tried to put his finger on the difference between which mitzvot does the Meiri-like approach allow us to get rid of and which ones does it not. Right? What is the, not get rid of, but meaning basically say it doesn't apply. You know what I mean? Right? Meaning what types of Isurim are we going to say that despite our appreciation of the non-Jewish world, we're still going to hold, right, b'chol tokvam, and not look for heterim, and say that the Meiri's heter doesn't help us for. Right? So what are they going to be? Ellie's right. They're going to be what?
Chasnas things.
Yeah. Things that are about intermarriage, or things that are about, right, not just do we appreciate you, right? Like, saying that I can't give you a present is not about, that's really, do I appreciate you? Right? I give presents to people that I have a relationship with. right? It's not really about intermarriage. Probably not. Doing business with you. Fine, that's about are you an idolater or not, right? Are you going to be mowed to a pagan god, yeah. Right? That's not about, as opposed to Bishalakum, like, right? Is
civilized, but they will.
Good question. And that's why I'm not totally sure that everyone gets the Miri right, but that was something I did with my share, and I can't redo it here. So Ravaran Soloveitchik really tried to put his finger on this. And so in his book, Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind, in a chapter called Jew and Non-Jew, what? I know, it's terrible. A Brisker talking about emotion. Oh, it's atrocious. Oh, Morty, what would you... yeah.
No true Brisker.
Okay. So he argues as follows, okay? So he argues that, in general, our relationships with non-Jews are run with the logic of the mind, right? But our relationship with Jews are also run by the logic of the heart. What is the logic of the heart? Or what does that mean?
Not real.
No. So he says, for example, right? His example is, I'm going to say some of this outside, but he says, for example, don't hold a grudge.
Right.
He says, is that rational?
Yeah.
No.
No.
Hold a grudge is not rational.
Well, so he doesn't buy the Rambam there. But he says, holding a grudge is actually perfectly rational. Someone did something bad to you, so you're angry at them. Like that's,
no, that's emotional.
Yeah, so he doesn't take that. He says it makes sense.
I know.
Okay? Right? Meaning, what's his argument? He says it makes sense, however you think a grudge, whether it's emotional or not. Meaning, it makes sense that if someone harmed you, right, that you don't just forget about it. Whether that means internally you are motivated.
You're saying that it makes sense that it happens a lot? Maybe, but it's not a good thing. It's logically not sound.
So he doesn't think that. He actually thinks that holding a grudge makes a lot of sense. He said, why would you tell someone not to hold a grudge? Again, you can argue on his particular, but let me give you his example. Right? He says, but why would you tell someone not to hold a grudge? Or let me put it differently. Why do your parents tell you, right, your brother slaps you across the face? The logical thing for you to do is to
slap him back.
Slap him back. Right, why do your parents... What?
The logical thing is not to slap him back.
No. So... What? No, not necessarily. He's less likely to do it in the future if you slap him back.
No.
He's more likely to slap you now.
That's not true. If you go to your parents...
Oh, God, okay. Give me a different example. This is Ravaran Soloveitchik's example, okay? Okay? You can take it however you want, right? His argument is that with... Okay, fine. You don't like it this way? Let me give it to you from Adam Smith, okay? Adam Smith, in his book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Have you, any of you read it? No. Adam Smith has two main books. What are they? His book on economics, which is called... Wealth of Nations. Right? And his book on ethics, which is called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. In The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he develops the following thesis. We function in a world of concentric circles. Right?
It's like the Mishnah.
Yes, correct. Amir HaKodman. And he says, what do you owe to the outermost circle? I mean, people you've never met.
Nothing.
No.
Less than the inner circle.
Justice.
Justice.
What is all that? You owe them is justice. Meaning you can't steal. Right? You can't steal. What?
Why, what is justice?
Meaning you can't steal from them. But I don't have to give you, but I don't owe you benevolence. Right? Meaning his argument is therefore.
Yeah, this
okay.
Is like...
Okay, so in a nutshell, let me explain you Adam Smith, okay? Adam Smith says...
He's saying those words, but what do they mean?
Okay, I'm going to explain to you.
What they did.
He said, why is it, Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, right? He says, why is it legitimate for people, for the economy to function based on people's self-interest? Because people, right, the anonymous economy, people out there, all you owe to them is fairness. I'm allowed to... buy and sell. As long as I'm honest with you, I can be motivated by my own self-interest. All I owe you is that I don't steal from you. I'm fair to you. I'm fair in advertising.
Yeah. Okay. As long as everyone's like,
right?
So not justice, just don't steal.
Well, that's what he calls justice. Meaning, don't steal, don't cheat me, right? I don't owe you. I'm allowed to function in my self-interest, right? As long as I am fair to my customers.
Yeah.
Right, I don't owe you more than that. I owe you honesty. You want to call it honesty? Right? He calls it justice. You want to call it honesty?
I call it don't steal.
Yeah, but it's more than that. Don't false advertise.
It's all don't steal.
So he calls it justice. You call it don't steal. I don't care.
Yeah, because justice
right?
is vague.
He spends two books describing what this means.
Right, so you can't sum it up with the word justice.
This is what he calls it.
No, I don't.
If I boss something, even though I'm stop, the stock stop, to go up, and stop. Boss will go down, like, people will
guys,
down
guys. And
you don't know what it means.
His point is, you owe them to be fair. You want to call it fairness? How about fairness? Does that make it right?
No, it doesn't help.
Okay. You know Gersley, just
have this conversation.
Oh, for God's sake.
You don't know exactly what it means.
Gersley, justice, fairness, I don't know. Right? In your innermost circle, you owe them what he calls is benevolence. Or what we call benevolence, what he calls beneficence. Right? Which means your brother, right? Your child, right? You don't say to them, what have you done for me lately? Right? You know, a parent takes care of their child even though their child owes them nothing, right? And their child will probably be ungrateful, like most good children, right? They will never fully recognize how much their parents have done for them. But you owe it to your child because that's the way life works. You owe your inner circle, the people who are closest to you, more than just, you know, justice. Or to put it right in halachic terms, the way the Ramban takes it, there's nothing wrong with lending money with interest. Right, and that's why a Jew is allowed to lend a non-Jew money with interest, because it's not wrong. You're allowed to do that, right? But why shouldn't I do that to my family? Because that's a really jerk move to do, right? If your brother is broke and comes to you and says, "Can I borrow money?" and you say, "Sure," at a 20% a year interest, right? That's a jerk thing to do, right? And you have the money, right? Like that's not a nice thing to do, right? That's Adam Smith's philosophy. Okay. That's Adam Smith's philosophy, that's the Ramban's philosophy, right? That's a combination of Ramban and Adam Smith there, okay? You happy? Fine. Coming back to Ravaran Soloveitchik. Ravaran Soloveitchik therefore says, our relationship, Gersley, listen, he says, our relationship, again, you don't have to like his terms, he says our relationship with non-Jews is dictated by the logic of the mind, right? Or what Adam Smith calls justice, or what Gersley calls don't steal, right? Meaning, right, you're not my brother, right? I owe you to be a decent human being, right? I don't have to be overly nice to you. I'm allowed to prioritize myself over you. That's fine, right? And if you hurt me, I don't have to now go out of my way to be nice to you in return, right? That makes sense, meaning but Jews, it's what he calls the logic of the heart, or what Adam Smith calls beneficence, or what modern English calls benevolence, or what I'll just call, for simplicity, brotherhood or family, right? I owe a higher level, right? Meaning, as much as the way a parent and child, right? A child can, you know, be chutzpahitic to his parents for years on end, right? We still think that the parent is a pretty bad parent if they kick their child out of the house, right? But on the other hand, if you had a random stranger as a guest, you know, your neighbor says, you know, do you mind hosting my second cousin? I have a bar mitzvah this Shabbos. And the guy comes in and, you know, spends the entire Shabbos insulting all the members of your family, right? I would be totally okay with you if you said, you know what, can you please go back to your cousin, stay on their couch, right? I don't need you in my house, right? But if you do that to your child, we say, you know, you're a bad parent, right? Because, right, so Ravaran Soloveitchik says, right, his formulation is as follows. He says, blind love towards non-Jews would be suicidal for the Jews themselves. Right? He says, looking at Jewish history, right, had we had blind love to the non-Jewish world, it would have been suicidal. Right? Oh, you're doing pogroms. I still love you. Right? Like, that wasn't, like, realistically the way we functioned. Right? But with Jews, so blind love can be commanded. He said, but, right? He said, but that doesn't mean that a relationship with non-Jews is not potentially one of friendship. What if you're dealing with good non-Jews? Right? Not those holding out programs. So he says, so then what's the difference between Jews and non-Jews? So he comes up with two terms, which I actually don't love, but whatever. He comes up with two terms, fellowship and friendship. Okay? So this is what he says. Look onto, I don't know what page this is, but the one, I think it's the last page, okay? He says, many non-Jews, and unfortunately many Jews, have fabricated a notion that the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Talmud, has no consideration, no compassion for non-Jews. They seek to substantiate this charge by citing the numerous laws which were enacted by the sages for the purpose of isolating Jews from non-Jews. It cannot be denied that our sages did enact numerous ordinances designed to establish safeguards against commingling with non-Jews. Our sages, for example, forbade partaking of non-Jewish wine, and that applies not only to the wine of the pagan, it applies even to the wine of the Gentiles of today who are not pagans. The reason for this is that the partaking of the wine of a non-Jew makes for associations conducive to intermarriage, which is the way the Chacham Sofer understands Stam Yenam. It's not actually what it says in the Gemara, but it's the way the Chacham Sofer does. There is a tradition that this is true. Fine. And there are numerous other such ordinances, like Bishul Akum, which is almost undeniably for this, the purpose of which is to establish safeguards against commingling of Jews with non-Jews. Thus, it is useless and absurd to deny the allegation that our sages endeavored to establish a fence between Jews and non-Jews, for it is true that they did so. And if it were not for these safeguards by our sages, the Jewish people would not have survived. But then he notes, not only did our sages provide safeguards against close association with non-Jews, they established safeguards against close association with non-observant Jews. Right? Meaning, by the same notion, they wanted you to avoid Ami Aretz, and they said Bas Talmud Chacham shouldn't marry a Bas Am Aretz. Right? Like, you know, this was a general problem.
I think, yeah, that would definitely be problematic.
So therefore, if you go now to the bottom over here, how he explains the difference, he says, Avos Derab Nosson explains this commandment obliges one to bear love, the blind emotional love to which we have referred for all Jews, even the Yisrael Mumar, even the Jew has become an idolater. It is to be applied indiscriminately. How can Allah, on one hand, declare that blind emotional love is to be entertained towards all Jews indiscriminately, on the other hand, establish safeguards with the obvious purpose of which is to prevent association with non-observant Jews? The answer lies in the distinction to be drawn between association in friendship and association in fellowship. Association in friendship means living together, helping one another, guiding, comforting, encouraging one another. In contradistinction to this type of relationship, association in fellowship does not necessarily involve deep concern for the welfare of the person with whom one shares fellowship. Association in fellowship means joining with together in intimate facets of life. It means playing together, drinking together, seeking pleasures together. In matters of friendship, the Torah does not want any separation. The Torah indeed condemns and bans such separation, and not only with regards to non-observant Jews, but with respect to non-Jews also, and even with respect to the Akum, the pagan non-Jews. No discrimination in friendship is to be applied towards the pagan. It is set forth in the Mishnah, as well in the Gemara, that just as we are obligated to support and maintain the Jews, the poor among the Jews, we are obligated to support and maintain the poor among the pagans. Just as we are required to comfort mourners, those who are overtaken by sorrow among the Jews, so are we obligated to comfort and encourage the pagans who are overtaken by grief. We are not allowed even to hinder a poor pagan from gathering the gleanings, the forgotten sheaves, and the field corners of the Jews. Any act of discrimination shown towards a pagan constitutes a violation of the principle of Darkei Shalom, which is a fundamental tenet of direct scriptural derivation, midoraisa, rather than rabbinic enactment. Right? This is alluding to his perush, which we've talked about, in Darkei Shalom. There are no limits upon friendship. It is scarcely necessary to state that there are no limits upon association friendship with non-observant Jews. As has been stated previously noted, the mitzvah of you shall love your neighbor as yourself is coextensive with each and every Jew. It is to be applied without discrimination to all Jews. But when we consider the association in fellowship, association of playing together, drinking together, feasting together, then it is another matter. Then association of any sort of fellowship with non-Jews is prohibited. Any sort of association and fellowship with non-Jews is conducive to intermarriage. Do we not see this today on campuses and the various colleges throughout the United States? That's your polemic for the end. But what is his argument? Again, I don't love his words, fellowship, friendship. I don't love it. I actually would have flipped it, you know. Right. But whatever, right? I would have put it the opposite. So let's leave his words out. But what is his basic idea? He said, if you want to put together a coherent philosophy of law that explains why we maintain Bishul Akum and Shechar Akum and Stam Yenam and parties with non-Jews and all those, on the one hand, but on the other hand, we encourage, right, supporting them, showing kindness to them, davening for them, things like that, right? The way he says it is that there's a difference between real appreciation of the other person, right? Like real appreciation, right? And socializing. He said anything that's about socializing, being your buddies, right? He said, we don't want that the non-Jews are your buddies, right? The ones you hang out with, right? Like Stam, right? That's what he thinks. Like friendship, he doesn't mean real friendship. Like, you know, friendly acquaintance, you know, when I want to have a good time, I go out with them, right? That we don't want because, you know, that, if I had to put it, he said, what Avraham Soloveitchik is thinking is, he wants your chevra to be Jewish, right? Like fundamentally, he wants your chevra to be Jewish because, you know, We want you to marry Jewish, right? We want you to live in a Jewish atmosphere. We don't want it to be that when you want to go out for a drink, right, you go out with a non-Jew, right? That's the type of thing that breeds, right, sort of a superficial closeness, but one that, you know, defines your atmosphere, right? But when it comes to appreciating the humanity of other people, right, recognizing the contributions they make to society, seeing value with them as human beings, right, which doesn't define your practical atmosphere every day, but does define your fundamental approach to their humanity, that he wants you to value them as human beings. And that's really, I think, the philosophy he's trying to get at. Right? And therefore, Bishul Akum, right, and all those related things are trying to prevent extensive socialization, right? Making it that non-Jews are your primary chevra. Right? That the Torah doesn't want. But any time where I'm not looking at them as my, you know, my gang, right? It's how do I view them as a human being, right? Do I appreciate what they contribute to society? Right? Can I have a meaningful conversation? Can we right, be involved in charity together? Right? Things like that. Right? Can we be involved in doing important things together? Right? Then the Torah wants you to recognize the fundamental dignity of every human being. Right? That's essentially, I think, the philosophy he's trying to get at. And therefore, all the social laws, obviously, we're going to be machmir on. Right? Because we still don't want you to intermarry. We still don't want them to be your primary chevra. Right, but those laws that reflect how do I relate to them as human beings, like Darkei Shalom, right? That's going to be maintained.
Is it
not maintained? Right, that's going to be opposite. Right, that's going to be where we have to recognize it. Now, part of buying into the Meiri is saying that there are even in the socializing, right? There are less that are going to be applicable, not none. Right? Yeah, Ellie.
What does it mean?
So that's what you don't buy, right? The logic of the heart, logic of the mind. You can read the rest of the piece, but I felt if I read the whole piece, Gersley would like have a heart attack on me. So he'll read it on your own time, right? I mean, his argument really is blind love, right? That you want Jews to... Right? He doesn't buy the Rambam, that the reason that you don't hold a grudge is because it's irrational, right? That's what the Rambam says. He thinks, no, holding a grudge is perfectly rational, not holding a grudge is irrational, and towards Jews you owe blind love. And towards non-Jews you don't owe blind love, you owe rational, what Paul Bloom, the psychologist at Yale, calls rational sympathy, right? Right, which Gersley probably likes, this notion of rational sympathy,
yes.
Right? As opposed to a blind love and maybe even an empathy, which you owe to Jews. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's how the Rabbanan Soloveitchik takes it. Again, you could have different nuances on it. Anyways, guys, so I hope that this sugya gave you, a little bit of understanding of lamdos, but also was a petach through the halacha into a bit of a philosophical framing, because I think, you know, at least once this year it's important to take a step back and say, what are these sugyas telling us about the relationship that we're supposed to have with non-Jews? Ron Soloveitchik presented a view. You can read through Rav Zvi Hoffman, who has a slightly different nuanced view. That's only one third of that article. I can send you the rest of the article if you're interested. The Rav, you know, in that chapter that I mentioned, develops that theory even more, but I wasn't going to make you sit through 80 pages. You can read it, right? But I wasn't going to make you sit through it. But I think it is something worth thinking about. And like I said, often I think, especially on issues like this, it's even more worthwhile to approach it derech halacha, right? Not just to see, like, theoretically, what do we say, but how does it play out in our life, than just asking it in a philosophical vacuum, rather than seeing how it emerges from the halachic minutia, okay? Let's take, like, a few minutes.